We're studying in Revelation 1, which is an exciting and a pleasant passage to study. And to kind of compare what we're doing in Revelation 1 versus Revelation 1 through 22, a couple of months ago, my family was blessed to go over to the East Coast, and I was able to experience the Atlantic Ocean from the standpoint of a jet ski. And would you believe it if I told you my back was still kind of paying the consequences of the jet ski, although I don't think John's is nearly as much. But that's one way to experience the Atlantic Ocean is from the surf, from the spray, and all that sort of thing. And another way to experience it is from the standpoint of thousands of sailors and aircraft pilots and all those guys who know the map of the Atlantic Ocean that gets you from Charlottesville to London. That's a little different thing. You're not going to take a jet ski from Charlottesville to London. And so if we just review the book of Revelation very quickly, Revelation chapter 1 is going to give us a picture of Jesus Christ, not in Nazareth, not as in the Gospels, but as he is in heaven. Do you remember in Revelation chapter 17, where Christ's only prayer for himself was that, I pray that these my disciples see my glory in heaven. They saw my poverty here on earth, and I pray that they see my glory here in heaven. That's what we focus on in Revelation chapter 1. Then in Revelation chapter 2 and 3, Christ is going to grade his congregations, kind of like a general reviewing his battalions before they go to war. Then Revelation 4, we see the Father. Then Revelation chapter 5, we see the Lamb slain on the altar. Then Revelation chapter 6 through 11 or 12, we see the various ways that the earth persecutes the church and how God responds to that. And then Revelation chapter 13, we're shown Satan's allies and his basic strategies and how those go on through the rest of the book, and then final victory in chapters 21 and 22. But in Revelation chapter 1, we see Jesus Christ, and it's an interesting thing, an exciting thing. There are about a dozen attributes of Jesus Christ, which are the same things that we will see when we pass from this life to the next life, and we wind up beholding his glory as it is in heaven. It says in Revelation chapter 1 in verse 10, I heard behind me a loud voice like the sound of a trumpet. We talked about this just a little bit last week. A refrigerator hum. I looked up the decibel levels of certain things in everyday life, and a refrigerator hum is about 40 degrees, and a normal conversation is about 60 degrees, and a lawnmower or a leaf blower is about 100 or 110 degrees, and an airplane engine as it takes off is about 180 degrees. The point of this is what? The point of this is that when the Lord speaks in his voice as of many waters, does the scoffer or the sinner get to ignore it? No, he's got a commanding voice that takes total control of the entire environment. And John is in the spirit, and he hears this voice that is God's. I didn't look up Niagara Falls. I wish I had what the decibel count is of Niagara Falls. But when God speaks, you might remember, you go back to John chapter 12, I think it is, in verse 29, and Jesus praised God, and then the Father answered him from heaven, and some people thought it was thunder, and some people thought an angel answered, and some correctly heard what it was that the Father answered. And can thunder itself, if it cracks suddenly and real loudly and real close, can thunder itself be kind of startling? Sure, well, the same thing when the Father's voice is compared to thunder. So I hear behind me this loud voice as the sound of a trumpet, and it's telling me, write down what you see in these visions and send it to the seven churches. Now, he says as he goes behind here, he sees the seven golden lampstands. They're going to equal the seven churches, as we'll talk about down when we get to verse 20. These lampstands have a function, obviously. Now, if we talk about as we talk about a broom, the function of a broom is to sweep things, and the function of a paper clip is to clip paper things together, and the function of a ink pen is to write, and the function of a lamp stand is to do what? The function of a lamp stand is to hold up light. 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 15 says that the church is the pillar and the ground of the truth. The function of this church is to do what? Hold up light. Have you ever thought about the fact that anybody in Sumner right now, as they lead their lives and they pray to God and the unknown God or whatever is going on, God is capable of sending them here Sunday morning, if that's His desired plan with their life, to hear that truth. And it's our job to be ready for it, for them to hear that truth, right? So these are the seven golden lampstands that Jesus Christ is in command of, and says down there in verse 13 that he sees a form like unto the Son of Man, which is a human form, goes all the way back to the book of Daniel 500 years before, Daniel chapter 7 in verse 13. Jesus Christ referred to himself as the Son of Man more than anybody else did. Jesus referred to himself as the Son of Man. And why do you suppose that is? When you think of Jesus Christ as the Son of Man in heaven, eon goes by after eon goes by after eon goes by, and then all of a sudden Jesus is the Son of Man. What do you think, Bill? Something in addition, right? There are angels who became human beings for a short time, or at least appeared as angels for a short time, but were they born? And did they have their diaper changed? And did they nurse? And did they grow up? And did they learn a language? And Jesus saw himself as partaking of flesh and blood, inasmuch as the brethren were partakers of flesh and blood. So throughout all history, Jesus will have sacrificed his riches that we might become rich from our poverty. Andrew, were you going to say something back there?
I think it is in direct relation to Daniel chapter 7 that he calls himself that too. Fulfilling of that prophecy, especially when you get over it, when he says, who do his men say that I, the Son of Man, am? At the end of that, he says, you know, you're going to see all the things that happened that are described in Daniel chapter 17 happen before this generation dies.
Yes, indeed. Andrew has studied the book of Daniel quite a bit and has taught the book of Daniel quite a bit. And the book of Daniel, we haven't gone through it before we went through the book of Revelation, but if you were to go through Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7 and Daniel chapter 9 and Daniel chapter 10, it would really unlock what a lot of these symbols are talking about. And here in the book of Revelation in chapter 1, if you've got the book of Daniel at your fingertips, you've got Jesus telling everybody, I am the Son of Man. I am the prophesied one of Daniel. You know, that's the same thing as what he's saying all the way through. Yeah, that's exactly right. Did I see another comment or question over here? Go ahead, Bill.
I was just going to cite read Matthew 5, 14 through 16.
Go ahead.
You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hid, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven.
Amen. And Mike, were you going to add to that?
No, I was just going to answer your question. Niagara Falls gives off a range of 87 to 95 decibels. Interestingly, a lion's roar is 87 decibels.
Oh, okay. From a distance of how far does it say?
I would prefer a far distance.
Okay. All right. So it also says that he has the hair as the head of white, and white symbolizes purity. And also with any son of man, a white head of hair symbolizes what? wisdom, and obviously, does a 20-year-old have white hair? No, you're talking about an old person. Here again, Andrew could say, could you go back to Daniel chapter 7 and find another prophecy about somebody with white hair? The Ancient of Days has white hair. So you go through all of these centuries upon millennia, upon millions of years, upon billions of years, and all these eons, and he has all this time behind him. And I sometimes I'll think about, the only way I can question it is I'll sit down sometimes in a chess skittles room and I'll be sitting there next to a grandmaster whose knowledge dwarfs mine, or sitting there in an emergency room and the doctor's knowledge completely dwarfs mine. I mean, I don't know biochemistry and anatomy and chemistry and all that stuff that he knows. And to pit your knowledge against his is utterly ridiculous. To pit our knowledge against God, everything he has seen just here on earth the last 5,000 years, that he's seen Alexander the Great come and go, and that he's seen the pharaohs come and go, and there's nothing new that happens under the sun, and all of the marital blisses and all the conflicts that come along, and all of the babies that are born and all the babies that are die, he's seen it all, right? And he's seen people pray to him, and he looks for faith. And that's what he tells Job, he tells Job, were you there when I laid the foundations of the earth? Why would you even question my plan in a given situation? With Job and his suffering, was that plan there? Was that plan in place? The entire thing was laid out from start to finish. So same thing when you're talking about his hair and his head of white is... God's eternity is something to keep in mind. He's the Ancient of Days, as it said in Daniel chapter 7. Go ahead, Ed.
I just want to take a second, and it's not to deviate from this a little bit, but when I was a young Christian, just kind of brand new, I had a really good friend. He was a preacher, and we were both young. He was a few years older than me. And we went door knocking. This was down in San Diego, California. So we went kind of door knocking, you know, to get Bible classes. You know, and you think about it, you know, you got Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons doing all that. But I was like a new Christian, and we went to this area in San Diego, and it was an apartment complex, and there was some, it was black family, and they were all excited. People wanted to talk about the Bible, and they were all, and it was, Jesus is black. Could he went right to this passage, right in Revelation, because his hair is like white wool, like wool, they'll be kinky, you know, it's going to be, that's black hair, right? And I didn't know how to handle this, right? I'm a new Christian. The preacher did such a good job. He says, well, you know, none of us really know what he looks like, but let's look at what Isaiah 53 says about the nature of Jesus, and let's look at the, you know, the character of Jesus, the nature of Jesus. And I kind of did it on that, not a black-white thing. He said, in that area, in Palestine, you know, if Jesus probably didn't have blue eyes and blonde hair or anything like that, in that area, people are darker skinned, but we don't know what Jesus looked like, but we know that this is a picture of purity. And so he kind of taught that way, and I really appreciate it, because we were kind of on the, I thought I was kind of on the defense, but I didn't know, you know, I don't know, you see what I mean, what Jesus looked like. But it was an interesting Bible study to turn it that way.
Mm-hmm. Right. 1 Timothy chapter 6, does God on his throne look like any human being? Now, does he look like a Chinese person or a male person or a female person? Or no, he's a spiritual being far beyond our comprehension. So that's interesting comparison. Okay, so anything else on that? His eyes is a flame of fire. What do you get out of that? Says that I look around and I look behind me and I see one as the Son of Man, and I see him as a robe. And we didn't really hit this one, but in the Old Testament, at least, when you see one wearing robes, that usually connotates a priestly sort, just as we're going to be talking about in Revelation chapter 2. And when you talk about a hair and head of white, it's purity, and in my mind, at least, an extreme extreme age, and now he turns behind him, and there's this extreme voice, and he sees Jesus, and his eyes are as a flame of fire, that if you were to look upon Jesus Christ, that his eyes are incredibly intense. What would that tell you? What do you think, Bill? You take an army soldier and he puts on night vision goggles when he's out on some vision and he's in the woods and it's at night and he can see 50 lumens when it's actually 10 lumens outside and he can actually see these things. And Christ takes a look and is there anything that can be hid from his view? It's a funny thing. I think every single one of us, as Jesus was looking at us, we'd have the sense that he knew everything we'd ever did and every thought that we'd ever had, right? John, you have a comment? This is one of the things that's consistent in the Old Testament, consistent in the Gospels, that Jesus is not a bored person, not a placid person, not a languid person. He is an emotionally intense person all the way through the Old Testament and all the way through the Gospels. And here his eyes are as a flame of fire as well. Good point that you make there, John. Anything up to there? So, the feet as burnished bronze. I guess you'd have to go back a couple 3,000 years, and 2,000 years ago, this would probably be completely obvious to you what this meant, the feet of burnished bronze. But nowadays, as tender feet, I'm a tender foot, it isn't quite as obvious. What do you suppose the feet of burning bronze would be? What do you think, Bill?
Prepared for the battle. I think it signifies perhaps a soldier who has his fighting equipment on. He's prepared for battle.
This is even in Ephesians chapter 6, and the one who's shod for war, right? And if you were going into war, and you had a sword, and you had armor, and you were preparing yourself for battle, and you were... Even if it were a rumble between us, 150 and 150 from over the hill, and we were going to swing swords, and it was going to come till somebody ran or somebody was killed or something, would you have special things on your feet?
Yes.
Did any of you guys wear metal-toed shoes to work?
Yep. Oh, yeah.
And what do you wear the metal-toed shoes to work for?
Protect your toes.
Yeah, In case some dummy knocks something off the top rack and it falls on your foot, the steel-toed shoes probably want you in the hospital anyway, right? But might keep you from losing your toes completely. So how about somebody whose entire foot is cast bronze? You think of somebody as high as the Space Needle, 600 feet. And decides to take a stroll through Seattle, and his feet are 30 feet long, and they're bronze, and he walks from Denny to Yesler, what happens under his feet? Everything's completely crushed, right? Isn't that what this is talking about here? And so he says, I looked at Jesus, and... The first time that Jesus came, his voice was gentle, like it says in Isaiah chapter 42 in verse 3, that he wasn't going to break a bruised reed, and he wasn't going to put out a smoking flax. But the second time he comes, it's going to be how? In judgment. That's how it's going to come the second time. The first time he came, it was gently. And we go through the Gospels. We go through Matthew and Mark and Luke and John. And we have Larry Haverstock this Sunday. But maybe the next Sunday when I preach, we'll have another lesson out of the Gospels. And it'll be a gentle lesson because that's how Jesus was in the Gospels. But in Revelation chapter 1, what's this picture that you get? It's a picture of a warrior that you don't want to be on the wrong side of, right? Go ahead, Bill.
So the reason read a passage in Micah 4, verse 11. But now many nations are gathered against you. They say, let her be defiled, let her eyes gloat over Zion. But they don't know the thoughts of the Lord. They don't understand his plan, that he has gathered them like sheaves to the threshing floor. Rise and thresh, daughter Zion, for I will give you horns of iron, I will give you hooves of bronze.
Perfect.
And you will break to pieces many nations. You will devote their ill-gotten gains to the Lord, their wealth to the Lord of all the earth.
Boy, how do you come up with such a perfect passage? That's exactly right. Okay, no, I'm just kidding around, Bill. Very good. He's kind of looking around like I'm serious. No, that's a very good passage. Thanks, Bill. Appreciate it. Go ahead, Mike.
And this description stands in contrast with Ephesians 6:15, where the armor of God says that our feet are shod with the readiness of the gospel of peace.
Mm-hmm.
And then again in Romans 10:15, how blessed are the feet of those who, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the good news. So again, in those passages, it would appear that the preparedness is for the feet to carry this gospel of good news and of peace.
And they're, right.
This is a different situation.
Those are feet of ambassadors of kindness, right? These are feet of a person you'd better not cross, right? That's exactly right. Okay, so feet of burnished bronze. I'm just kidding, of course. That's an excellent passage there that you brought up there, Bill. The feet of burnished bronze and the voice that's stunning, like the Father's voice is stunning. It's shocking and it's loud. And we looked up on that decibel point. It had... as it rated the decibels for any particular sound, it rated how long the human ear is supposed to be near it before the human ear suffers damage. And the loudest thing on there was an airplane engine at takeoff, which is supposed to be 180 degrees, and supposedly only 2-3 seconds before it suffers damage, supposedly. This is a loud voice that commands attention, and there may be a person who's snickering and what's all this Bible stuff, but when they hear this voice, that's not their attitude, right? Do I have a question? Go ahead, sir.
We live just down the road from Luke Air Force Base in Arizona. The F-35 engine, if you're within 50 yards of that when it runs, it will destroy your internal organs.
Oh, really? Which makes you wonder how they take off and land and how they...
That's an uninsulated engine on a test stand.
I see. Isn't that interesting? So here, same thing, very loud voice. And a voice comes out as a two-edged sword. Maybe we should go over to Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 12. I think it's about chapter... Well, let's see. Let's wait on chapter 4, verse 12. We'll go over to... Who wants to turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 10 for us? And we'll read 2 Corinthians chapter 10. Ed, if you're there, go to 2 Corinthians 10. And we're going to read verses 3 through 6. Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 12 says that the word of God is quick and more piercing than any two-edged sword. Now, of course, that firstly refers to Jesus as quick and piercing, but also are Jesus' words and truth quick and piercing and penetrating. Mankind is so good at deception and is so good at huddling into a mass, and if we 50 people over here vote that we're in the right, no matter how much we're lying, then we're okay, no matter how much you over there might think you have the truth. But Jesus Christ's voice is penetrating, and his eyes are penetrating. And same thing that it says in Hebrews chapter 4, verse 12. Now, in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 3 through 6, it tells us that we have weapons that tear down all pretensions. And what that means, as Ed reads this chapter, this verse here in 2 Corinthians 10, 3 through 6, what that means that we have weapons that tear down pretensions is that we have the truth. And we kid about this, and we've mentioned it before, but what's the trick to winning a debate? be on the right side in the first place, right? And then all you have to do is go look up the right answer, and the other person comes up with something you don't know, and there's going to be an answer somewhere if you're the one on the right truth. And that's what 2 Corinthians 10 is talking about. Go ahead, Ed.
For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses. We are destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised against the knowledge of God. And we are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. And we are ready to punish all disobedience whenever your obedience is complete.
And he's just talking about reason and ration and truth and logic and God's word and all it equips us with. Okay, yeah, go ahead, Bill.
I was going to say that the passage that you had cited there in Ephesians 6:17, that's Makaria versus Ramphia.
Yeah, those are the two words I remember.
The two different words. One referred to a short sword that you keep, you know, in a scabbard. The other one was one that was almost as tall as a man was, and it was kept in a shoulder sling.
Yeah.
And it was when that was swung, it was a sword of judgment, not injuring. It was.
Yeah, that's accurate. And since Bill brings it up and credits me with quoting Ephesians 6:17 there, probably half of you had noticed and half of you hadn't. These are Paul Hawthorne's overheads that we're using. He put together a long string of 22 chapters worth of very detailed overheads. And rather than retype them all out myself, I thought I'd go ahead and just use them myself. And why not use my own notes as we go along here? So if there's a mistake, give Paul Hawthorne a ring. They're definitely his fault. but other than that, that's what we're doing here. Bill, did you have another comment there?
I was going to say that clearly a short sword like that, you're able to do fine work, you know, fine hand-to-hand work.
Right.
And you can decide or show between right and wrong and devour cut up. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens when we evangelize, we take God's word out. Clearly, that's why, you know, Paul says to Timothy that we're to study it, be able to know what is the right and the wrong, and to separate, make the difference. And I think in using the sword that way, we're able to finally show the difference between.
Makes a good study, doesn't it? You know, the gigantic sword that you use for swinging in a huge battle and the tiny one that you use for close quarters combat. That's exactly right. Okay, so Revelation chapter 1, Christ among light lampstands. So verse 17, I fell at his feet as one dead. And we mentioned last Sunday or the Sunday before, I think it was, mankind always reacts to anything truly spiritual by passing out. And why is that, do you suppose? Why is it that every time we fear, you know, we see something truly spiritual and pure and holy, we head for the forest and we head for our fig leaves? Do you suppose that's because we're righteous or because we're sinful? Right? So that's one thing to keep in mind. But also, I felt his feet as one dead. It just has to do with how intense that God is. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 16 talks about him as a light unto which no man can approach, that no man can see him and live. It's just an intensity situation. How do you measure light? Is it lumens that they say or something? Lumens or lux or whatever it is, you know, how many lumens or lux would God be, you know, compared to what man can stand? And we talk about F-35 liquefies our organs, and kind of probably not a bad comparison as well. So I felt his feet as if I were dead. Verse 17, and Christ himself says, I was dead, and I am alive forevermore, and I have the keys of death and of Hades, and this is a comfort to the saints. I experienced death, and it couldn't hold me. Now, One of the things that comes up throughout Revelation is Christ mentions at least half a dozen times that he was truly dead. That the Son of God truly died, and then he was truly raised from the dead, just like Lazarus was raised from the dead in John chapter 11. And in Revelation 5, he celebrated that way, that he gave his entire existence and his life into the hands of the Father, and he trusted himself to the hands of the Father, like it says in Revelation chapter 22, what is it, Book of Psalms in chapter 2 in verse 31, that for the rest of all eternity, Jesus Christ will be able to say, I had eternal life, and then I had a period when I was dead and I depended on the Father to raise me up, and that was the kind of faith I had. And this is going to be talked about again in Revelation chapter 5 in different spaces. Having the keys of death and of Hades, one of the things we might think of when we talk about elite keys and so forth, think about the nuclear codes, for example. Who's in charge of the nuclear codes right now? President Trump supposedly has the keys to nuclear codes. Does that? I'm not trying to be political here. Does that make you comfortable or uncomfortable, or that any one person should have keys to the nuclear codes? Jesus Christ has keys to the codes of what? Life and of death and of Hades, meaning he has the authority to open them. He has the keys of the kingdom and the knowledge and the keys of the abyss and so forth. And in chapter 1 and verse 20, it's going to talk about the mystery of the seven stars, which it continues to chapter 2 and verse 1. The mystery of the seven stars. A mystery isn't something you can never understand, but it was something that wasn't understood before, and now it's about to be revealed. And what are those seven stars? Let's leave that for next week in chapter 2 and verse 1. Sometimes it's used, stars are not used of priests and prophets that I know of, but sometimes priests are used as representatives of a group of people. And Paul here maybe takes one little point that's different from me, and he takes an individual as a representative of people. So when he'd be talking about talk to the star or the angel of the church of Corinth, he'd be talking about a particular man who would then be custodian of the word to that people. I'd be thinking more in terms of talk to the soul of that congregation. Talk to the spirit of that congregation. Talk to the personality of it. Do different congregations have different personalities and spirits and atmospheres and cultures? And that's kind of more the way I think of it. And particularly, the first thing I'd bring up as supporting my own point of view is, would there be a single person that God would be addressing as the star of a particular congregation? That would be a little more questionable to me. So I don't know. It's possible that point of view is what it's thinking about. But more, I think, is talking about the congregation in the sense of its totality and its spirit and what it's getting done and all that kind of thing. Okay, questions or comments through Revelation chapter 1? Ed. Right.
So it's like this, so you get this picture, and I guess it's figurative to give us, and I guess I just wanted to bring that out, that to me, whenever I see figurative language in the Bible, it wants to give it more meaning, I mean, like, more emphasis, like, meaning deeper. And the analogy, you know, I always use is, that's not a real plant behind you, but if I say the plant needs water, if I say the plant is thirsty, now I'm giving it, like, you know, I'm giving it, like, and I think it's the same kind of thing with Picture Day. When it says life, it is just very powerful.
Two good points you made, and I forget to make these points, which is, first of all, it's never saying that Jesus' feet were actually brass. It's saying his feet were like brass. And then Ed says that can actually mean more. If I told you Ed's eyes were like penetrating fire, that's actually saying a little more than if I said his eyes were actually penetrating fire because he was wearing a Halloween mask or something like that. So, yeah, good point. All right, we'll pick up in Revelation chapter 2 next time. Thanks.